Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today is Associate Editor Byron Hurd. What's going on, man?
Hey, not a lot. Just came back from a nice long weekend road trip. Got to put the TLX Type S through its paces a little bit. Get to talk about that. It was a very informative drive.
All right. Sounds good. This is the V6 with 355 horsepower, I want to say it. So it's a little bit of an upgrade over our A-spec TLX, which is a little less powered, if you will, but pretty fun car to drive as well. We also have the Jeep Grand Cherokee, which you drove out at, was it Moab?
Yeah. All right. Out in Moab, that was fun.
I drove the Grand Cherokee L in Michigan, which was also actually pretty fun, but we talk about just, you know, to me, like what the Grand Cherokee means right now. You know, it's a very important vehicle for Jeep, and this is perhaps the most significant redesign they've done. And I mean, to me, it goes back to like 2010 at least. So yeah, this is very significant. And we will talk about the BMW M240i. So lots of good stuff, and we will spend your money. Lots of good stuff to talk about on this show. If you're listening to this, hey, happy Thanksgiving. It's Thanksgiving week. I hope you're enjoying the Autoblog Podcast wherever you might be. Let's talk about the Jeep Grand Cherokee. You drove, just to be clear, there's now actually two versions. There's the L, which has three rows, and then the Grand Cherokee, which is the traditional two-row model, which is what you drove out at Moab. So
bingo.
We kind of thought this would be capable off-road. John Snyder and I, our green guy, were talking about this a while ago, and he threw that in there. And I was like, yeah. But I drove the L, and it was almost like a luxury, SUV. And it really was, with the seat massagers and the huge screens. Very nice. But there are some differences here. And I think one of them is that the slightly smaller Grand Cherokee is probably a little easier off-road and more capable, just because you can, it's easier to avoid trees and rocks and things like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, real quick, what did you think?
Well, I mean, you pretty much nailed it. I mean, they let us drive both the regular, like, quote unquote, on-road versions. And because the two-row is the carrying on the traditional Grand Cherokee formula, it also gets the Trailhawk model. So that gets like the extra off-road goodies. But really, it's using the same tech to do two different things. You have the Summit Reserve models. They drop the air suspension down low, put it sport mode, and it's a great cruiser. It can even carve up some corners. They actually dropped 200 pounds or so out of the two-row model compared to the old one. So the three-row actually weighs as much as the old two-row did, and the new two-row weighs less. And you feel it. It actually feels like a nimbler, like more compact vehicle. But it really, dimensionally, for the two-row, didn't change a whole lot. The interior got roomier, and they shifted the packaging around a little bit, lowered the center of gravity. The engine sits lower. The front half shafts actually go through the oil pan. Like, it's very fancy, just trying to make it handle more like a car than the kind of big, bulky, midsize SUV that it is. And honestly, the tools that they used to make it a much better car on-road were exploited to make it better off-road. So the Trailhawk model, you get extra ground clearance from the air suspension. You also get the fancy e-diff in the rear, which is an electronic locking, or no, sorry, not locking, limited slip rear differential, which is important. The front end, like all other Grand Cherokees, I'm pretty sure even down to the base model, gets the very simple, like, brake-based torque vectoring that pretty much everything can do now. Like, it's, pretty much built into anything with a decent stability control system at this point. But basically just to, when you have a wheel that's spinning, it brakes it to try and slow it down and transfer some of that torque across. So you don't get, like, a Rubicon experience where you have front and rear locking differentials. You do get the electronic disconnecting sway bar, which is nice because it actually improves your articulation a little bit off-road. But that's about as close to a Rubicon type situation as you get with Grand Cherokee. But even with just the limited slip diff and the brake diff up front, it handles itself really well. It sits really high off the ground when you put it in off-road mode. And we had a crew of maybe seven Grand Cherokees in our little off-road trek that we did. And we went up around, it's called Raven's Rim, which is literally like if you're standing in Moab, you can look up at one of the mesas, and it's right along the edge of it. So you're looking down over the town. It's very beautiful. It's very narrow, and it's all rocks and cactus. So All of us made it through, like, I will say literally without a scratch. I don't think anybody put a ding on a car that wasn't, you know, like on a skid plate or something like that, which is pretty good for how these things go, especially with Jeep, because they don't really play around when it comes to their off-road courses. Like, they want to show you that these things are capable, not just that, oh yeah, you can drive it on your farm road or whatever. They want to prove that if you decide you want to take this thing overlanding, it's a pretty good canvas to paint that picture. So I was pretty impressed by it, you know, for not being, you know, Rubicon hardcore. It's a pretty impressive car and just amazing on the road. I'm really impressed with what they did. Even with the V6, it feels really good. The Hemi's nice, and honestly, to a degree, even feels kind of antiquated compared to a lot of the powertrains we're seeing now. Like, that's my biggest beef with Grand Cherokee in general, is that while, you know, the chassis is great, the interior tech, like the new infotainment system, the side screen for the passenger that gives you access to the nav system, but also like personal infotainment. Each position in the car can have its own Bluetooth headphones. So you could literally have three people in the car watching something on Amazon or Netflix. Everybody gets their own audio. Everybody gets their own thing. You can be watching the same show and watching three different episodes of it if that's what you want to do. So obviously not for the driver. It's for your passenger and your rear passengers. But it's pretty cool tech. And the passenger side screen hasn't even made it into the L model yet. For now, that's still exclusive to the Turo. So we're assuming that's coming as soon as Jeep can do it. We're kind of, at this point, I think everyone's assuming, even though Jeep won't confirm it, that it's a chip issue. Like, they just don't have the parts to build them that way. So yeah, I was incredibly impressed. It's a great car, and the 4xe is coming soon. So if you want a more advanced powertrain, you want that plug-in hybrid and some electric range, just hold out for that. They're even doing a Trailhawk version of the 4xe. So that's going to be, as far as we know, limited to two-row, just because of what you said. It's the more off-road capable model because it's shorter, more contained, more nimble, and it just makes sense to do that. So I was generally quite impressed by it, and what a beautiful place to drive a car. It was my first time actually staying in Moab, so that was a lot of fun.
I've never been to Moab. I've done the Rubicon Trail, which was really something on the bucket list. We camped out there, which was pretty awesome. So Jeep really puts you on some interesting trips, let's put it that way. But Moab is obviously on my bucket list. We can trade. You can do the Rubicon, and I'll do Moab next time or something.
There you go. We'll get that invitation to go drive 4xe, then Greg's off to Moab.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really interested to see, like, what the 4xe does for, like, the Grand Cherokee. You know, I know some of us have gotten through the Wrangler version of it, so I think that, you know, I'll give Jeep credit. They've been aggressive at rolling out this, you know, it's like a measured, electrified approach to their lineup. It's not like, you know, this, you know, total Tesla fighter, but it definitely offers you something. And, you know, in light of recent, like, inflation and things, the prices aren't insane. You know, I feel like in some ways, I don't know if this makes sense, but in some ways it feels like inflation has helped Jeep, because their vehicles have always been pretty expensive. But now when you're like, oh, geez, this is how much this thing costs, it's like, well, you know, I don't know, Grand Cherokee or a Wrangler or whatnot sounds pretty good. Now, what will you actually pay at the dealer, and can you get it, and all that stuff is a different story. But yeah.
Well, I mean, to Jeep's credit, it's one of the few manufacturers where we haven't really heard a lot about them having to shut down due to shortages, supply issues. And I'll tell you, when I was driving back from the DC area yesterday, that would have been Monday, depending on when you're listening to this. I swear I had to see 20 or 30 car carriers coming down the Ohio and Pennsylvania turnpikes loaded with Wranglers and Gladiators coming from Toledo, just load after load after load. So they're definitely still cranking those out. Even, you know, going into a holiday week, they're still sending them out. So that's the good news. I mean, especially if you're hurting for a 4x4 and you're turned off by the fact that Broncos are so thin on the ground and they have issues, I mean, Jeep will gladly sell you a car, and they've actually got them to sell, which is saying a lot in the current climate.
Now, I'm curious, like we mentioned right off the top, this is the biggest Grand Cherokee redesign since, you know, again, over a decade, I would say. And obviously, like, the one I drove is now the three-row, which is, you know, just completely broadens the lineup. And really, to me, this makes Grand Cherokee, like, I mean, they weren't hurting for sales, but now they, like, they could really compete at all parts of this segment, because, I mean, it's table stakes. You've got to have a third row. Even if your third row, it seems like the primary function is to, like, fold it down. You know, it just seems like you got to have a third row, right?
Yeah.
Because everything has one. So I think they did some interesting things to differentiate them a little bit, like some of the interior things, and obviously the size. But it's my sense is maybe a year or two on, the only real differences will simply be the size. I feel like they're going to kind of like collate, if you will, to get them where they are.
Yeah. Agreed.
But I mean, I was impressed with the L. It sounds like you were impressed with the regular one, if you will. So, I mean, I think this keeps them very competitive in this segment, near the top of it. So, you know, it's solid, you know, solid vehicle. Any other thoughts from the trip?
No, I think that covers it pretty nicely. I'm with you. I think you're right. They'll consolidate everything down to the point where there won't be any difference between the two of them besides the number of people you can fit inside and how much they can tow. I would really like to see them come in with either a replacement for the Pentastar V6 or another engine underneath it that's a little smaller, maybe even like a smaller version of the 4xe, maybe like a, you know, smaller is the wrong word, but a lower output version, just to be kind of a more economical option that isn't as antiquated as that V6 now is, because that V6 at this point is as old as the Grand Cherokee redesign, because if I recall correctly, that was one of the cars that had actually not necessarily debuted, but that was one of the like marquee cars that Chrysler put that engine in when it was ready. And it served them very well, obviously. I mean, they had some initial kinks, but that engine's been pretty much flawless ever since. But, you know, it's old. I mean, a decade's a long time for anything in this business. And, you know, anybody proves that they can do it, it's Stellantis. But at a certain point, it's time, you know. So I'd like to see a change there. But yeah, overall, fantastic car.
Yeah, no, that is one historic engine. And it's still reasonably competitive. You know, I think back to times in the car business when, like, you might remember the 08 Mustang when it was at the end of its lifestyle and it had that, like, really underpowered V6 in it. And even the V8 wasn't at all competitive by today's standards. And it wasn't by those standards either. This Pentastar, at least, it's okay. It can carry the water, but I agree with you. It'll be interesting to see what the Stellantis global footprint can leverage and get into some of the U.S. vehicles. So why don't we shift gears over to the M240i? This is pretty important vehicle car for our readers, BMW. What did you think of this?
So I really liked it. When we first saw the new 2 Series Coupe, I really liked the looks of it, mostly because I think the 2 Series Grand Coupe, which is a completely different car and front wheel drive based and, you know, really shouldn't even be in the same sentence, looks kind of frumpy. And that might be being kind. It's just not a very good looking car. The 2 Coupe looks great. And it came in this, I've got to look up the name of this color on the BMWs because it's just fantastic. And there we go. Thunder Night Metallic. How ridiculous is that? So it's a really deep purple, like that color you get like as lightning's fading in a thunderstorm in a night sky. That's where they get the image. Because I literally looked it up. I figured it was like, you know, German, like they just like taken the same word and translated it to English, basically. That's not the case, because Donnernacht is not a thing, apparently. But when you Google that, you see like photos of like lightning in the sky, and I swear it looks just like the color on that car. It looks beautiful. But it's a great little car to drive. You know, I'm a fan of like compact and subcompact rear wheel drive sports sedans and coupes. And, you know, getting behind the wheel of that thing, it feels great. Steering's great. The engine is fantastic. I personally would probably not want an all wheel drive car that small, because I feel like that's a lot of weight you're throwing into a small chassis. I'd rather keep it, you know, light and nimble, but it performs beautifully. The ride's a little firm, but I'm also a little biased. Cadillac has that beautiful MRC 4.0 adaptive suspension, and I've already been spoiled by my Blackwing, but it's a fantastic little car. I would wholeheartedly recommend it to anybody who's been waiting to see what's going on with the new 2 Series. Zach did an excellent first drive review on that 2, which we also have already live, and then I'll have a follow-up road test for you guys with a little bit more just, you know, local knowledge thrown in. But yeah, very impressed by it, and I think it looks great. Even not in that awesome purple color.
So this one is 335 horsepower with the M-tuned straight six, which is kind of cool. I'm not sure what yours cost, but it actually starts at about 46. 0 to 60 is 4.4 according to the BMW website. So to me, that seems like, even though it's small, you get a lot of car, and the stats seem to add up. Most BMWs, I mean, you know, there's a few outliers where the horsepower is like crazy, but they're never going to be like Hellcat levels of like, whoa, look at this. So to me, 335 for something this size seems totally right. And it's, to me, it's a little bit of a quasi-traditional approach in a segment that we've seen go a few different ways.
Yeah. So. And I mean, figure too, like one of the things that kind of was going against BMW for a long time, especially in this segment, was that you could get a Mustang or a Camaro V8 with most of the performance options you want for probably like $40,000. And that's just really not true anymore. You pretty much start in that territory to get into a Mustang GT or a Camaro SS or a Challenger or Scat Pack. So now the value proposition shifted, because the one I was driving was spec'd out about close to $60,000, but it was pretty much every box check. We're talking adaptive cruise, all that kind of stuff, which BMW really firewalls behind some expensive options. So when you try to load these things up, they get pricey. This actually comes off kind of reasonably, because while you don't get as much raw power, you are going to get about as much performance as you would from a pony car. And it's more flexible performance, because you do get the all-wheel drive. So, you know, you throw on a set of winter tires, that thing's going to be unstoppable. So you have some advantages to it, and you're not really spending the premium that you used to have to in order to get one of these. So, you know, the increasing price of pony cars has kind of made these even more enticing than they used to be. And I mean, the last time I'd driven a 2 Series coupe was the M2, and I drove that out at Laguna, and I was blown away by that car. I loved it way more than the contemporary 3 Series, and that's when BMW was really struggling with 3 Series steering. And 2 Series didn't seem to have really fallen behind quite as far. Now that BMW's kind of caught back up, I'd say the gap there is much smaller, but I still think the 2 is a better car to drive. So it would get my vote of the two of them. And the value proposition is definitely there more than it has been in the past.
I would agree with that, especially for the rear wheel car. The numbers I quoted were actually for the rear wheel. Horsepower is the same. All wheel drive is actually a little quicker at 4.2 seconds. And then that's where you see the starting MSRP is 48,350 now, as I flip through the Bimmer website here. Still, I think that's, I mean, for all-wheel drive, that's not a bad surcharge to pay. And I would agree with you. The pony car segment is, unless you want like really one of those basic Mustangs or Camaros, which are great. I encourage you to, like, if that's what you're doing, you know, you're kind of almost in like BRZ territory, Miata, just like you're sort of like maybe going up a size, but still going with that very pure dynamic. But generally, the Camaros and the Mustangs and the Challengers cost a bit of money. So, you know, even if you get like a Scat Pack or something with like the 392, which, you know, I believe that's still north of 40. So, I mean, and that's a different approach. You're getting a big car with a lot of power. You know, the 2 Series offers you something a little bit different. So this is appealing to me. I've always liked BMW rear wheel drive performance, the coupes, like the 3 Series, that element of them has really appealed to me just, I mean, since I got into the industry. You know, I mean, it's, I think for most of us, it's, you know, those two areas, that those areas resonate deeply. But yeah, we'll see. I can't wait to drive this one. Now that you have driven it and Zach has driven it, feels like I should get a chance behind the wheel of this. You know, now that we've written two stories, we could send it to me and, you know, talk about it on the podcast or something, right?
Yeah, sure. Soon enough, I'm sure. And I gotta say, like, really the only thing you're giving up with the 2 Series in terms of, well, the most significant thing I would say is the 4 Series, based on the larger 3 Series, has a genuinely usable back seat, especially if you get the convertible, like, you know, because you drop the top and you got all the headroom of the world. The 2 Series back seat is definitely a just in case proposition. It is not meant to be used on a regular basis. So that's the real trade-off there. And, you know, if you're shopping for one or two rather than three or four, then yeah, I think you'd be much happier with the 2 Series than the 4.
Sounds good. So let's shift over to the Type S. This is kind of our sort of long-termer at the moment. Yeah. Our A-spec TLX has been out of the shop for a bit. So we've been using this loaner, which is awesome. And you actually really put some miles on it. I did a lot of around town driving, some aggressive driving, I would say, But you actually got to kind of stretch this out and think, would I want this version of the TLX with more power? Is this what I'd really want, you know, for like long road trips? So with that as preface, I mean, you know, how's this kind of hold up is like with an ownership type of experience?
Yeah. I have not been blown away by the Type S so far. And I'd really only done what you described. It was mostly driving it around town and all that kind of stuff, which you didn't really get to enjoy the things that make the Type S special when you're just using it as a, you know, surface street commuter car, basically. But I put a good chunk of mileage on this thing driving to and from DC. And I accidentally boxed myself out of an exit I needed to take in Pennsylvania and ended up going on the turnpike about 20 miles farther than I'd planned and had to take a detour that sent us on some mountain roads through basically what is like southern western Pennsylvania ski country. And we're talking back roads with, you know, 45, 50 mile an hour limits, very twisty, lots of elevation change. And I was just like, you know what, let's actually, you know, see what everybody's talking about with this thing. And threw it over into the most aggressive, you know, sport modes with stiffened up the dampers and everything. And actually tried to attack it a little bit. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what matters about this car. Cause it really does handle quite well for being so big. And you actually get to use the power. I mean, that engine can actually, I would say it's somewhat uninspiring day to day. It's fine. It gets the job done, but it's not very exciting. And, you know, for highway passing and stuff like that, it works, but you don't really get to take advantage of its strengths that way. And I mean, that thing is fantastic on a back road. I was really blown away. Mostly because I kind of had, you know, low expectations for what I was about to do when I went into it. So this is finally me saying that I've come around on the Type S. I was definitely in the A-spec corner leading up to this. And now I'm saying, okay, like if you can justify the cost, the Type S is actually a heck of a lot of fun to throw around. It really, I mean, it weighs close to 4,400 pounds. It's a big car. Doesn't look big, but it is. And, you know, but when you get it on a back road and you actually throw it around like that, you don't feel the weight. And that matters. So I've done a 180 on that car. I'm now on Team Type S, at least as much as I was on Team A spec. So it's a nice little awakening for me.
Interesting. So it's your money. Which one are you going with here at this point?
I'm probably still going with the A spec because
interesting. Okay.
Strikes against the Type S. We live in Detroit, so personally, and you know, the A spec makes a little more sense because I'm not going to get as much time to really flex that muscle and go out and charge around really fun back roads or anything. And the frugality of the smaller engine's appealing. That was another thing I learned on that trip. That's got a big tank, and it likes the juice. I think we were probably pushing about a 25 mile per gallon average, which I think was actually a mile per gallon better than EPA says.
It's not bad.
Yeah, we had a pretty good steady cruise. We didn't have much of a headwind going either direction. So it did pretty well. And, you know, two people in comfort for, you know, 500 miles each way. Can't argue with that.
Been on that Pennsylvania Turnpike a few times, several times, actually. It can get a little dreary. And
it's better than Ohio, at least, because does things. There are turns and hills, and like as an Ohio man, it's just pretty straight, especially from Toledo to Cleveland. There's just nothing happening.
Oh, 100% Pennsylvania over Ohio. I will agree with you there. You know, I go back and forth. I feel like I've been on both sides of it here, A-spec or Type S. I definitely was on A-spec at the start of the year. Then I drove it and sort of prisoner of the moment. I'm like, oh, no, Type S. This is what I want. I like more power. So here's how I'm going to try to bring this together. I think if it was like just in general, I would do Type S. I like big potent V6s. I like how it looks. The brakes look good. Like there's a lot of touches on it that make it a little over the top. For truly my money, I would probably do A-spec though, just because for like real world driving, like this is money, fuel economy, like frugality, like actually like, you know, not like fake press car, like money, like real world, your money, I would probably do Type S, you know.
Yeah.
Or excuse me, A-spec. Maybe that was a Freudian slip. I don't know. But I think I would do A-spec. But we'll see. I mean, you know, I'm not going to buy either. But, you know, I don't need a sports sedan in my fleet. But, yeah, I will say this. Acura's had a good year. You know, the Integra reveal looks impressive. I think the TLX rollout has gone pretty well. You know, we're talking about two cars here. We're debating them as enthusiasts, but we like them both. Like, this isn't like, well, this one's kind of not great. You really got to do this or you're driving a penalty box or something. It's like, well, no, they're both pretty good. We've given both pretty good reviews. I believe the TLX is an editor's pick. I'd have to double check. So we have, you know, generally liked this car. So,
yeah.
So should we spend some money?
I think it's time.
All right. We have to spend my money. So we're getting to it a little quicker this time, and that's okay. So Scott in Texas writes, good evening, Autoblog team. Just finished listening to the Cadillac Blackwing episode and heard mention that you need spend my money questions, so thought I'd write in. Thanks, Scott. Okay, so currently a three-vehicle household. He drives a paid-for 2014 Ram Cummins 2500. His wife drives a paid-for 2019 Ford F-150 or 250 Power Stroke 4x4, and they have a 2019 Jetta GLI 6-speed manual as the commuter car for work. Drives about 4,000 to 6,000 miles per month on the GLI, with about 1,000 to 1,500 of those being business and the rest just commuting miles. So he's driving some cars. They live an hour and a half from work. So it's an 86-mile commute all interstate because the mile changes. The oil changes come due every fifth weekend. So that's a lot of, that's just a lot of driving. That's a heck of a commute. It's been a while since I've commuted, and that reminds me that I really don't want to. I mean, just that many of oil changes is quite stressful. Okay, so the GLI has been a fun commuter car, especially with the 6-speed. Would love to hear some recommendations for a replacement. Needs to be fun because you spend so much time in it. Comfortable for long drives, reasonably priced since it will depreciate so quickly due to the mileage. Get good fuel economy, cheap, easy oil changes, and it must be a manual transmission. Caps. All right. Previous vehicles on his car plan include a 2018 Ford Fusion with the 1.5 liter EcoBoost. Let's see, the Ram 2500 diesel and a 2012 Toyota Tacoma V6 pre-runner. That's cool. All right. So that's what he's owned. And this is what he's looking for. Essentially, he wants like a pretty decent commuter car to replace the Jetta. We don't have other than just like a reasonable price, and let's just maybe throw it in that kind of Jetta GLI framing. We don't have a specific price, but I will throw it over to you. What are you thinking, Byron?
Well, I told Greg earlier, I was like, this is kind of a narrow ask, especially once you get to the manual transmission bit, because the combination of manual and good fuel economy is becoming very difficult to find. So I went to the EPA with this one. I just pulled up fueleconomy.gov. And did a search for manual transmission cars that got at least 30 miles per gallon highway. I picked that kind of arbitrarily, but to me, that it still constitutes like decent highway mileage, especially for an enthusiast car. And it also actually gave us some options that were vaguely enthusiastic. So there are a couple on here that are actually pretty promising, like the Elantra N line, which is interesting enough. That one gets the fancy independent rear suspension instead of the twist beam on the base model and stuff like that to get, I think it's 200 horsepower. That's not a terrible little car. And it's big enough and it has long enough wheelbase that it's certainly going to be comfortable for road trips, but still, you know, slightly more aggressive suspension tune. So it should actually be fairly fun to drive. But looking at these, like the combination of him wanting simple maintenance and all that kind of stuff, I'm looking at the turbocharged pony cars. Because you figure a Mustang or Camaro, certainly comfortable enough for, you know, for two people to go on a road trip in. You've got backseat if you need it. Convertible gets you even more backseat room if you can actually drive it without the top on all the time. The nice thing about these two is, yeah, they're designed for much larger engines. So that engine bay is going to be much more roomy than some of the like compacts, like a, you know, a Mini Cooper, GTI might be a better like all around practical car. But in terms of like doing your own maintenance and stuff like that, they're going to cost more. It's going to be harder work and you're going to bust your knuckles more trying to get to and from parts. It's hard to argue with the simplicity of a, you know, big old fashioned, if you want to use that word, pony car with a tiny little engine in it that's easy to get to. So we love the EcoBoost Mustang. I love the Turbo Camaro. I don't know if you've driven one or not, but I've driven it and liked it. My only beef with that was I didn't love the pedal placement and the and like the pedal box shape inside the cabin. So that's definitely a, you know, try before you buy type situation. But I think for actually checking all the boxes presented, those might be the most appealing options. And then, you know, if that's just not enough, I mean, there's plenty of ceiling in a pony car. If you want more engine, you can get it. So
that is, I mean, when you talk about fun to drive, manual, a little bit of car around you, you know, like Camaro sounds pretty good to me. I'll say that. I saw a Camaro the other day when I was walking the dog, and I was just thinking to myself, man, the design of the like this current generation Camaro really does hold up pretty well. I know they had some issues with the grill a couple years ago, but you know, they really got just a nice blend of like, you know, modernistic interpretation of the classic Camaro. There's a lot of like late 60s in there. To me, the proportions almost throw a little bit of like the 1970 model, which is my personal favorite. So I concur. That's not my pick, but I concur with what you're saying. I think that could be a lot of fun. But my choice is going to be a little bit different here. I'm going to go with the 2020 Honda Accord 2-liter with the manual transmission. It's a little bit of a bigger car, more something like kind of like a Jetta GLI if you're in that kind of budget. Let me see if I can find the fuel economy ratings. I have like three different EPA tabs up, which is a little random here. All right. So let's see if I can find it. Oh, where did the 2-liter go? I had it, then my dog lost her mind. Okay. So here we go. 2-liter, 4-cylinder, manual, 6-speed turbo, regular gasoline, 22 in the city, which is not great, not terrible, but on the highway, it's 32. And you're going to be spending a lot of time, it sounds like, on the highway. So 32 miles per gallon is nothing to sneeze at. And it's a pretty nice car. I've always liked the Accord. I like this current, the styling that they have with it. I think it's, again, it's a good size car. You know, there's a lot of things in that segment that are, you know, pretty credible. If you're a car company that's still in this like midsize or above segment, generally you have something pretty good. So there's that. So that's what I would go with. I guess it's technically a used car at this point, but, you know, that would be my choice. Other things I've driven, just looking at this list, the Corolla hatch with the manual. I just drove that last week. Great car. A lot of fun to drive. I would go with the bigger Accord on the highway just because, yeah, I have a little more car around you, you know, and do that. I know he said must have a manual, but I also would say, hey, look at a Dodge Charger or a Chrysler 300. Since you, mainly when you started to bring up domestic pony cars, I always think, LX, which is not a pony car, but the Challenger is on that chassis.
Yeah.
So you might find you like one of those as far as highway cruisers. So
yeah,
those
true. And honestly, if you're cool with a V6 powered LX, I mean, you can get a manual transmission V6 Charger, and it wouldn't be my choice, but
Challenger, right?
Not I'm sorry, Challenger. If I said Charger, that's okay. my mistake. You can, yeah, so a Challenger is an option. And honestly, I mean, my 392 on the highway did 24 miles a gallon, which, you know, if it's literally all interstate, that might be tolerable for you, especially coming from a truck. But I mean, I certainly wouldn't consider it good fuel economy, but I would certainly consider it surprisingly good considering it's a, you know, 4,400 pound V8 monster. So.
Sounds good. Let's get to Ryan in West Virginia. I believe a friend of yours has a family car, a Pilot, for his wife and kid duties, and wants something more fun for himself without being too impractical. A sportier SUV / CUV options are on the table. Should have 2 rows, 4 doors, and all-wheel drive, a hilly area that gets snow often in the winter. Budget $25,000. New or gently used. I have that John Denver song now going through my head. So, yeah, I'll kick it over to you since this is kind of the friends and family plan here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so not the first, but the thing that I kind of narrowed down to is one of the kind of like dark horse entries for small CUVs was the Hyundai Kona, which,
yeah,
I mean, it's not an exciting car. I will acknowledge that up front, but the small footprint and all wheel drive, especially with the turbo engine, it's actually a lot of fun to drive. It is. A group I was on a few years back, we did a compact crossover comparison test, and the Kona was the only one that showed up that was a subcompact technically, But we had a CX-5 there. We had a couple other cars. And the car that was second most fun to drive out of everything behind the Mazda was the Hyundai. And I mean, yeah, the interior's a little on the cheaper side, especially once you start to load it up and you get towards like 30,000 with the all-wheel drive and turbo. But if you're getting one used and, you know, it's depreciated a little bit and you're getting it more in this price range, I think it's a really good choice. I threw out a couple of the other kind of standards, like, you know, you can get into the CX-5, it's perfectly good, CX-3, CX-30, if you want to go a little smaller. You know, like there are options there from Mazda, and I mean, even Honda CRV is not the worst thing in the world, but I wouldn't consider it fun. So, you know, the Kona is kind of where I settled, but I wanted to get more opinions on this for him. So that's why I suggested he do this.
Sounds good. So you may hear the barking in the background, you may not, but my dog's name is Bloom. Her sister's name, she was from a large litter of dogs, was Kona. And I think there was a Luna in there as well. So you can hear the barking, the Kona fits with the dog. And what I would say my pick is the maybe a used Mazda CX-5. I think it's sporty. It looks pretty good. It's, you know, you're going to like the steering. You're going to like the handling. I think the styling is just, you know, it's going to be spot on for me. If I were in this, like, if this is what I was looking for and this was my criteria, I mean, I don't think you're going to go wrong with a CX-5. If you just do a quick search for a 19, like used one, you're going to, I mean, the prices are so like out of whack right now. It's a little hard to figure, but I'm seeing them everywhere from like low to mid 20s to upper 20s. And it's not terrible, you know? I mean, especially again, for like, I searched for a 19 and that, you know, comes right in there. You could find some stuff in the Autoblog listings. I'm seeing some stuff on KBB here. But I think that's where I would go. I mean, you can always go a little more boring and go like Outback or the RAV4 is pretty good, but mindful that he's looking for something that's got a little bit of like, you know, elan, if you will. I mean, usually Mazda is pretty good at carrying the water for that. So, hopefully you have a good, good time with this car purchase. It's a good time of the year. I don't know if it's a good time of the year to buy it. It used to be a good time of the year to buy.
It did. Yeah.
Now it's hard to say. So
yeah, I feel bad. I think he's been searching for a car for probably over a year at this point where he just can't decide like what he wants and nothing really good's fallen into his lap. So it's just a matter of like, he has working transportation, so it's not that urgent, which is a wonderful place to be right now, because if you don't need a car, this is a really terrible time in history to be shopping for one. But, you know, depending on what you're looking for, you can still find a lot of good, healthy options. And even going back to our previous spend my money ask, you know, like one nice thing about going after a coupe or a sedan right now is that they're less popular and they're more likely to actually be on lots, especially, you know, we're talking Texas, where, you know, you look at a truck dealership, they've got nothing on the lot, but there, you know, be a few Dodge Challengers and Chargers and stuff like that sitting along the back fence. They're like, hey, you want one of us? Because we're still here. So, you know, you got options if you know what to look for and you're comfortable with what you can actually get.
So now that I have John Denver stuck in my head, a quick Google says he wrote Country Roads while driving to a family reunion. So I think that's probably a good way to end the podcast here. It's Thanksgiving. Hopefully, you know, you can, you know, find a way this year to see some friends and family and be safe and have some good food. I'd say Country Roads take us out, but I think that's like trademark infringement, so we can't do that. But thanks for listening. Obviously, we'll be back next week, but have a great holiday. Happy Thanksgiving. We'll see you next week.